On the line, all going well, we should be able to hear Phil McCabe. Morning, Phil.
Kia ora, Aaron. Kia ora, whangaroa. Miss you all.
So we have seen in the news talk of a seabed mining moratorium, and the news is related to the New Zealand government. Do you want to clarify exactly what that is?
Yeah. So we're talking, you know, there's a big push globally to open an area to deep sea mining in the Pacific. The scale is massive. It makes the TTR proposal look like child's play. But it's in an area between Hawaii, if you can imagine, from Hawaii to Mexico down to Kiribati, which is south. So it's an area that covers.
That's huge.
From east to west, it's 4,500 square kilometers. Kilometers. Which is as wide as the United States, so it is a massive area, and the international waters is, you know, it's deemed the common heritage of humankind, so we all have an interest in it, and it's governed by an organization that's mandated by the United Nations under international law, but it's not actually part of the UN system, but the organization that. I mean, the authority that manages, you know, basically half the planet, international waters, on behalf of all of us, is based in Kingston, Jamaica. And a bunch of my friends have just gone back there this weekend, and there's a two-week meeting starting again on Monday. And I went to one of those meetings back in August, early August, in Kingston. And, yeah, so... What was the question? What's going on with the moratorium? So there's a big push to get mining started and start happening. And once it starts, it'll, you know, you won't be going backwards.
So Phil, can I just check? Like that area you've talked about, there's not actually any islands in that area. There's no actual nations.
No.
Is that why they've picked that area, because they think there'd be less opposition?
No, that area has a particular type of environment. It's 4,000 to 6,000 meters deep. It's sort of abyssal plains, although it's not all flat. But it's full of these polymetallic nodules that are full of metals and valuable metals that companies want to turn into money. But you know, the argument is that they can be used for the green transition. But there's, yeah, that's another story. But no, that area. It's been targeted for a number of years, and you know, there's 17 licenses already issued, exploration, not exploitation, so not actually mining, but exploration licenses. And each of those 17 licenses is 75,000 square kilometres.
So what has New Zealand signed up for, and how many other countries have signed up?
Yeah, so I was in Lisbon here for the United Nations Ocean Conference back in June, and... some Pacific Island countries, we were helping them make a call for a moratorium to pause that process of opening up that area. And those countries were Palau, Fiji, and Samoa. And it was a huge event, actually. It was the UN Ocean Conference was big, but this actual event amongst dozens and dozens of events over the week, this was the sort of hot topic. The deep sea mining was the hot topic. And Emmanuel Macron, the French Prime Minister, flew in and said, "Yes, we need to We need to write the rules that stop this from going ahead." And you know, so it was quite a big thing. And that was back in June. And we've been pressing New Zealand to join this call for a moratorium. And we've actually been working with them been meeting Minister Mahuta for over a year. We've met her four times, and finally. They came out and called for a moratorium on deep sea mining in international waters last week, which is huge because, you know, it's for all of us in New Zealand, we've been fighting this since 2005 in Whangaroa, and the rest of the world hasn't actually. It's all quite new. We've got more history with looking at this and scrutinizing it than any other country in the world.
Oh, really?
So
okay.
New Zealand's ahead of the game, and it's important that we've, as a country, have stood up and said that, and it's super positive. Yeah.
Presumably, based on what I understand, the same issues, which they're saying, oh, the science is great, and the reality is there's no actual science for what happens when you go and just monster into the seafloor like that, like I presume they're proposing to do.
Well, that's the issue. If you don't know what exists there, then you don't know what you're breaking. And if you don't know the system, you know, it's about the organisms that live there, how they rely upon the structure of the habitat, and how they relate to each other, and the ecosystem services that whole ecosystem provides, i.e., carbon sequestration. You know, just it's one of the largest. I mean, I think the deep sea is the largest carbon sink on the planet. And you know, these companies and countries are suggesting we go and disrupt that and disrupt the systems. So, I think the lack of science is basically one of the pillars of our call to stop this before it starts. The other pillar is that we know through our experience in New Zealand, we know that strip mining vast areas of the ocean floor cannot be done without breaking stuff. So that's not okay in the 21st century, and basically all of the countries in the world have signed up to not doing that, you know, through international law.
I mean, when you say breaking stuff, that doesn't really give us the whole picture. Like, are they talking about using these machines that are the size of a house to go and dig down, destroy everything 6 meters deep, or, you know, I can't remember the details.
It's strip mining. So when I say breaking stuff, that's a crude way of saying they're damaging the ocean floor. They're killing organisms. There's a high likelihood of extinctions. The impacts would be permanent on human timescales. So the nodules that they're looking to collect, the sort of potato-sized rocks that are scattered across the seafloor and sitting in a soft sediment.
Okay.
And the nodules themselves are the structure that provides space for the organisms to exist. So if you remove the nodules, you're permanently altering the ecosystem, and the nodules take 10 million years to grow. So it's not like, I mean, felling native forests is one thing, and you know, that's not a good thing, but eventually they would grow back. These wouldn't.
Much more permanent long-term damage, like really long-term.
And I mean, even if you think of the TTR application in South Taranaki on the west coast of the North Island, it's a really active environment. You know, there's a lot of wave action and currents and so on. And so the organisms that exist there are quite resilient to movement and disruption and disturbance.
Yeah.
In the deep sea, it's like the moon. The currents are moving super slow. It's crystal clear water. They're not accustomed to disturbance and sedimentation. So very fragile ecosystems.
I remember one of the things we talked about, where we talked about plumes of crap dust for what was happening with the TTR proposal here. Is this likely to kick up plumes of sediment?
Yeah, plumes of sediment, and there's two sort of plumes that get created. One is the machines, these massive machines that would be disturbing, you know, the seafloor as they go along. But then they suck the nodules up to the ship on these massive pipes, and then they pull the nodules out, and then they dump the wastewater back, and they would be dropping it back at about 1 to 1,500 meters, so 1 to 1.5 k's. And that water would contain all kinds of toxins, you know, and potentially fine metals, and potential impact to tuna fisheries, and you know, all sorts. And then you've got the noise impacts. So there's a recent research that's been done and says a single mining operation would create a wall of noise covering a 500 kilometers radius from the site. So, and then if you have, you know, multiple of these across the whole region, you're completely altering the soundscape of the deep ocean.
Does the sediment plumes, do they drift, or is that area so still that
they
that's...
Do, They do, and it's all, it all comes back to modelling at the stage. You know, it's all sort of conjecture and modelling, which was similar to what happened with the TTR case. But yes, they would drift. There's modelling that says in one of these blocks, then and the country of Tonga is sponsoring the company in this block that they did this modelling, that within 3 months, I think the sediment plume, or the plume from the wastewater, would reach Hawaiian waters. So,
oh, okay, that's not really very long.
You know, so but I mean, it goes on for 30 years or even longer.
So, Phil, I used to live, when I was a kid, I lived in the islands on these three little atolls in Tokelau, and it was just an experience that my family happened to have because of a job my father had. But I know that the people there are completely dependent on the sea for their food. Atolls are not, for people who don't know, atoll is just a string of little islands around a reef with no big island in the middle. So the soil is not very rich, so there's not a lot of stuff grows, mostly coconut trees. And so, yeah, completely dependent on, not just for food, but I mean, for instance, they catch fish and they eat the organs of the fish because that's where they get all the minerals and nutrients that they need in their diet, because they don't get it from the land. So this is possibly more serious than people might imagine.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's the scale of even one of these mining, you know, I said there was 17 permits. Even if just one was granted, it would be the largest mine site ever in the world, you know. So it's significant. But the positive thing is that there's been a political shift. When we were here in Lisbon in June, that was sort of, these countries broke the political ice.
Yep.
And there's been a bit of a, there's definitely been a shift in the last few months. And I was in Lisbon in June and Kingston in August, and then in September went to New York for the United Nations General Assembly week, when all the leaders were there and had a meeting with half a dozen countries, including New Zealand and others, and about this. And there's a grouping of countries that are coming together and going to start pushing. I've got the next meeting for me is on my way home, going through Egypt to the climate conference in a couple of weeks, which will be interesting. And we've got a couple of events lined up there to talk about this. And I think, the momentum to stop it is growing.
So you met with Helen Clark when you were at the UN Assembly.
Oh, it was crack up. Me and the New Zealand lawyer, the guy who works for the government on this issue, we just had a coffee and walking up, I don't know, one of those fancy streets,
yep,
and literally bumped into Helen Clark on the street. And I was like, I said, Helen Clark. She said, yes. And I just about carried on walking, but then I sort of went back and I saw you on a webinar a while back and you mentioned deep sea mining. Thank you for that. And she said, oh, it's the Wild West out there, you know, and because I talked about the International Seabed Authority that governs that whole half of the planet on our behalf. They're corrupt as all hell.
Right.
And it's a one-way track, and the Secretary General, or the boss of that organization, is off the planet, really. And for a UN organization to be behaving in the way that they are is really upsetting a lot of countries, the countries that care about, you know, good governance. And so, you know, like some weird stuff's happened, but one of the most weird things was when we were there in August, the mining company that's sort of leading the charge wants to go and test mine their machinery, and the environmental impact statement that they provided was substandard, and the ISA, the International Seabed Authority, said no, you can't go, and everyone was, you know, quite pleased with that because it was a crap,
yep,
crap report, and then everyone said, oh, well, they can't go test mining. And then two or three weeks later, they put out a press release. The company put out a press release and said, we got our permit. We're off. And they're out there at the moment test mining right now. But it was literally like fell off the back of the ISA truck. No one knows how it got consented. No one knows what the process was. No one knows what the information was that changed the mind.
So no one's kind of watching the space. There's no accountability.
Lots of people are watching, but one of the bodies within the ISA meets behind closed doors, and they only report what they feel like reporting. And and so countries, the ISA is actually made up of countries, 167 countries plus the EU.
Yeah.
And the Secretary General, it's the Secretariat. They are like the secretary of those countries, and the countries are supposed to be in charge, and the Secretariat's supposed to do what the countries say. But the tail's wagging the dog.
Yeah.
At the moment, and so countries are getting quite upset about that. And I think starting tomorrow at the next round of meetings there, I think it'll be pretty interesting.
So you bumped into Helen Clark. Is that actually much use, or is that just kind of a nice story that you?
Oh, it was a nice story. And actually, two or three nights ago, she said, "Oh well," I said, "I'm working on this issue globally and part of a global campaign." And she says, "Well, just tag me on Twitter and I'll retweet." And she's been retweeting my tweets. Mm. And then I was chatting with her the other night, we had maybe a dozen exchanges just on. You know, what needs to happen sort of thing, which is quite interesting.
So what's her position at the moment? I forget.
She was the UNDP, UN Development Program. I think she was the Secretary General of that or something. I don't know what she's doing at the moment, actually.
But a bit of a power broker in that part, that sort
well,
of...
Well, you know, she's the next Prime Minister. She's led one of those organisations. She went for the UN Secretary General last round but didn't get it. Mm. You know, so she's an influential... interestingly, and I haven't raised this with her, but hopefully I'll actually get to have a sit down with her at some point, but she's the one who opened New Zealand waters up to seabed mining back in 2004.
Right.
So... The story is really that New Zealand looked at this, thought about it, realised we had resources at the bottom of the ocean that we could exploit and make money from. But when it came down to actually scrutinising it and seeing if it was, appropriate, it got shown to not be appropriate. And that's what we're finding on the international stage.
So how many countries, like you say, momentum's building, how many countries are kind of on board with having a moratorium on seabed mining in international waters?
Well, four months ago there were zero, and then up until last week there were four, and with New Zealand coming on board, it was four Pacific Island countries, and now New Zealand's on board. I'm pretty confident in Egypt, we'll have at least two more come out with very similar calls. So, but I think things start small and they grow, and especially when it makes sense, it just doesn't make sense to push ahead with it.
I imagine that a lot of countries are quite oblivious to this. I mean, that was our experience here in New Zealand. Like, for instance, we knew about it on the coast, but the rest of the country wasn't that aware of what was going on.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so, but there are countries that do engage, properly at this International Seabed Authority, and quite a good number of them are showing concern. Mm-hmm. I think what we can take from this is, like, I'm super stoked that New Zealand, Nanaia Mahuta, she's the minister. We met with her the first time we met with her. She said we had a 45-minute call lined up. After 40 minutes, she said, "Is everyone okay for time? Because I'd like to add another half an hour." Mm-hmm. So she was really concerned about it, and she said, "I'm concerned about this, but it will take a while to turn the ship around." And it's taken over a year. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But she's done a bold thing here. It's a whole government approach. The whole of the government is behind it, and I think what it's going to grow into, or what's going to occur, is that. That domestically in New Zealand waters, I think they're going to do something similar.
So, sorry, your voice just faded there. Did you say do something similar?
Yeah, I think domestically in our waters, I think we're going to see a moratorium or a ban. And that's a pretty bold thing to say. But Debbie Ngāru Opaka that from the Māori Party has a bill for a ban about to be read in Parliament, and I think we'll see some movement around that.
She's the perfect person to have in there, isn't she?
Yeah, she's pushing hard, and I think, you know, it all springs from all the time and effort that everyone put in, and all the contributions from our little town and up and down the coast. So.
And let's talk about, like, you're part of Deep Sea, the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition, so, and the Pacific Regional Lead. So this is a global organisation. I mean, I guess for this issue, it's the only way to deal with it ultimately, isn't it? Is to reach out across the world and connect everyone up. Who might be people working away by themselves in different countries, not aware of the rest of the world.
Yeah, exactly. And so our organisation, we're a team of about 8 people, and our organisation is made up of over 100 organisations spread all around the world. You know, Greenpeace, WWF, David Attenborough's organisation, organisations in Asia, South America, all over the place. And so we are leading the campaign, and then the network is also working across in their own respective circles in their countries and in their networks. So it's a massive campaign, gaining heaps of momentum.
So one thing I remember from the past, I don't know if you remember the GE moratorium that we had in this country. It lasted 2 years, and then they didn't extend it. So my question is going to be, how long is this moratorium going to last?
Well, New Zealand has tied their moratorium call. They didn't put a time frame on it, but they tied it to robust science, the need for robust science. And the minister's comments said that we know very little. We have an extremely low level of knowledge of the deep ocean, and we're going to need a lot more scientific knowledge before we can decide whether we should go ahead. So the tie to the lack of science means, you know, it's not an overnight fix. It would take, and there's been estimates that it would take many years to decades to build up the scientific knowledge.
And I presume this area in particular, folks, we're talking about an area in the Pacific where there's no islands, vaguely round Hawaii, shall we say, to the right of Hawaii on the map, where there probably is less science for that part of the sea than almost anywhere else, I imagine.
Well, yeah, the deep ocean is hard to get to, and it's massive, you know. So they say we know less about the deep ocean than we do about the moon. And I was talking to a scientist when I was in Jamaica, and she said the biodiversity, the diversity of life is such that you might put a, she said, you might put a grab, you do a grab in one location, and it's sort of like a shovel that goes down and grabs stuff and brings it back up. And then you might do another one just 70 meters away or 170 meters away, and it's completely different organisms.
Right.
And they, every time they do a grab, they're finding stuff they never knew existed. So as far as organisms. So, you know, it's...
So my next question is if they decide to start researching the deep sea and the seabed, is it all going to be done by the commercial organisations who will hold on to the information and just present the information that they want to present? Or the other way of putting this, I guess, is there money out there to pay for public science to happen? Well,
that's the sort of next stream of the campaign from our perspective, is that, yes, to date, a good chunk of the science is being done by the companies, but what we're calling for is for massive investment in independent research, for knowledge, for the sake of knowledge, rather than for the sake of, you know, mining. And, you know, so we're looking to big philanthropists and developed countries like the States and Europe, in New Zealand and Australia, to support the Pacific Island countries to build their scientific knowledge and build their scientific capacity across the region.
You know, some of those Pacific nations, they're so tiny, and I mean, all the ones that have got atolls, like I talked about atolls before, like there's so many of them throughout the Pacific. They need help.
They do. When I was in New York, we got dragged into the Tongan embassy and ended up sitting next to the Tongan Prime Minister for 3 hours drinking kava. And, you know, he's sort of, they do need support. They need support with scientific knowledge, and really it needs to be Pacific people learning and building, you know, their capacity over a long period of time.
All right, well, Phil, look, it's been really, really good to talk to you this morning and get. I'd just seen headlines, so I was confused. I probably thought there was a seabed mining moratorium around New Zealand waters. You say that might be coming up soon.
I reckon we'll see it before the election.
That would be helpful to have it before the election. I can't imagine. I don't know what would happen after the election.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, thank you for your time, and it's probably time for you to go to bed soon. So have a good sleep.
Getting there. Yeah. Hey, thanks heaps, and kia ora, everyone.
And when are you back in Raglan?
Back home in a month.
In a month. All right, man. Well, look, we'll try and catch up with you then.
Okay.
Kia ora. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Yes, Phil McCabe in Lisbon right now. I think when I talked to him at the start of the weekend, he was messaging me about the interview. I think he was in London at that point. He's been in New York, Egypt next.